While this nation has been tested by war, and it's been tested by recession, and all manner of challenges, I stand before you again tonight, after almost two terms as your president, to tell you I am more optimistic about the future of America than ever before.
President Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention in August, preparing to hand over to the 45th President of the United States of America. Rewind to 2008, when Obama was elected and the BBC drove coast to coast, speaking to Americans about their lives and dreams for the future. Now the BBC is retracing that journey to find out if the first mixed-race president has lived up to his promises of change and hope. You can listen to the first two parts of that road trip from California to Tennessee with reporters Philippa Thomas and Chloe Hadjimatheo in episodes 1 and 2 of America Revisited. I'm Michelle Fleury, and today producer Ben Crichton and I are on the final leg, beginning here in Louisville, Kentucky. We'll be pushing on through West Virginia and Ohio before finishing in New York.
And they're on. Load start for not this time. Spot the field, 3 lanes for the opening jump.
While the rest of the country and much of the world has an eye on the presidential race, we've got ours on an old-fashioned horse race at Churchill Downs in Louisville, home of the famous annual Kentucky Derby.
Oxford Lane running in second. Coming outside the pond is now third.
8 years ago, when the BBC was last here, the country was reeling from the financial crisis, and the horse racing industry was far from immune. But like the rest of the economy, things have started to pick up again.
There in the gate, and they're off. Bossy B veered to the far outside, soon after the break. Paraveer's off very
from his cramped glass booth overlooking the one-mile dirt oval racetrack. Announcer Travis Stone enjoys what he calls the greatest view in horse racing.
Run along back into second, late run from Morgan Ruby on the outside, but Paraveer's the winner by one on the wire. Run along was second, Morgan Ruby's was third, and Unbridled Harlan finished fourth.
I barely heard you take a breath there.
Yeah, squeeze them in.
I mean, obviously you have a very rarefied view from up here.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think things are doing right now in America in the economy?
Horse sales are going well. The horse racing market sort of mirrors how the general market is doing because it's a game that people with a lot of money are involved with. And if they don't have that disposable income, they don't buy horses. But they're buying horses right now, so that's a good sign.
And how many years have you been doing this?
I started calling races in 2006, so 9, 10? Yeah, 10 years. I was right out of college. Got my first announcing job 3.5 months later, and haven't stopped since, so yeah.
And is this a job you see yourself doing until retirement?
Hopefully, God willing, yeah. I mean, I do this for free if the rest of life didn't cost money. So, yeah, absolutely.
So I'd expected to find optimism here. After all, America is now several years into its economic recovery. But chatting with some of the visitors, I was surprised to find people still having such a tough time.
I found it easy to get a job maybe 10 years ago, and then now I can send out resume after resume and not even get a call for an interview. So, yeah, it's changed a lot for me.
What do you do?
I do sales.
And are you looking for work right now, or are you in a job?
Looking for work. Yeah, for sure.
Have you had a flutter today?
I won the first couple of races.
That's great. How much did you win?
I'm a $2 better, so I won about $15 on the two. So
that's great.
Yeah, that's not bad. I'm, you know.
In percentage terms, that's a great return.
Oh yeah, I'm going to go home with more money than I came with. So even if it's a few bucks.
It feels like they treat us as we're very replaceable and not respected at all. Even as many years as I've worked as a nurse, it's very difficult to find a job that will pay a decent wage for my experience. The last physician's office that I worked with, I was paid $12 an hour, and I had no benefits. So that was very disheartening.
You feel the little guy isn't being looked out for?
Not at all. Not at all.
Horse racing is not really about those placing the bets, but rather those behind the scenes. It's often called the sport of kings, or in today's language, a sport for the 1%.
It's predominantly just kind of like a wealthy person's playground. We deal with a very select clientele that can afford to play in the game. Recessions and downtimes in the economy obviously affect them also, but maybe not as bad.
Travis Foley works as a horse trainer, like his father and his grandfather before that.
I got out of school in 2006, and then I graduated grad school in 2008, and it was slim pickings locally, and there weren't a lot of job opportunities. It seemed like everybody was hurting a little bit. And I don't think anybody's doing fantastic, but it's certainly heading in the right direction considering where we were 10 years ago.
You think things are looking up?
Yes.
So the owners you deal with aren't subject to the same concerns as your average middle-class, lower-class family?
For the most part, yes.
America's rich, the kind of people Travis Foley works for, have had luck on their side in recent years. They are still winning. But now I'm headed across the border from Kentucky to West Virginia, the bluegrass state, and a place with more than its fair share of economic losers. With its thickly forested mountain slopes, it's hard to believe that coal was once king here. In fact, it's so central to the state's psyche that there's even an image of a miner on the state flag. But the last few years have seen a decline in the fortunes of this once booming industry. There's a lot of talk in these parts of President Obama's war on coal. Many people blame him for mine closures. In the 1950s, the industry here employed some 125,000 people. Today, mechanization, the rise of natural gas, and a downturn in industrial production worldwide, not to mention many company bankruptcies in the last several years, have driven that number down to barely 20,000. Walmart, not the coal industry, is the state's leading employer these days.
My name is Bo Copley, and I'm a currently unemployed coal miner here in Delbarton, West Virginia. I was laid off from my job in September of 2015.
Bo Copley meets us outside his church in the small town of Delbarton, home to around 500 people, nestled in the tree-studded hills of Mingo County. He's a proud, deeply religious man of around 40 and father to three young children. But despite his current predicament, he counts himself lucky.
While jobs have been hard to find for myself, my wife has been able to sustain our family through her business. A lot of people don't have that to fall back on because coal mining has always produced good money. A lot of spouses have stayed home and been stay-at-home moms, so a lot of people have had to find another way to produce.
Earlier this year, Bo was invited to appear on a local panel discussion with presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton. He made headlines around the world when he confronted her about previous comments she'd made about the coal industry.
I prayed about it all day Saturday. Sunday, I prayed and fasted. And when Monday came around, really, God just kept putting in my mind, show her your children. Give her a picture of your children and show her faces that politicians, I don't think, sometimes see. I just explained to her that the comments that she had made in an earlier interview that she was going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business was not taken very well in our area. And we were told she was there as a friend, and I told her that she wasn't viewed as a friend.
And I gather it made you a bit of a local hero.
I guess you could say that. There were a lot of pats on the back and people telling me that I did a great job. And a lot of people perceive us as poor, uneducated people. And everyone has told me, thank you. You have represented us so well, and people aren't looking at us like we are just a bunch of hillbillies, I think is the main thing that I've heard. And so
it's tough for you to talk about.
Yeah, it's been very humbling.
Hillary Clinton later apologized, insisting her previous comments had been taken out of context.
Hi, this is a message for Doug Green. It's Michelle Fleury from BBC. You may remember you spoke to...
Back in 2008, the BBC Talking America bus spoke to two old-timers, miners Billy Mitchell and Doug Green. I've been hoping to track them down and find out how life's changed since then. But so far, I haven't had much luck getting through. The state of West Virginia is one of the poorest in the Union, and as we continue our journey, we pass countless dilapidated shacks and boarded-up storefronts. In this God-fearing part of America, it's increasingly the church, not the government, that people are turning to.
Hi, how are you doing?
Wonderful. Tired. Wonderful.
We catch you in the middle of something.
Always.
An hour's drive from Dulbarton lies the town of Madison. It's called, rather incongruously, the gateway to the coal fields. At the local Christian centre, I bump into John Miller, hard at work restocking the food shelter he and other volunteers run for Madison's most vulnerable. They rely on donations to keep things going. According to the state's largest emergency food provider, one in six West Virginians will visit a food pantry, soup kitchen, or shelter in 2016. It's a startling statistic.
We got pears and cranberry juice. We got beans and stew and walnuts and raisins.
So, I mean, it's the full nutritional range.
Yeah, absolutely. And we always try to give them some kind of snack or something for the kids, too. You know what I'm saying? Some cookies, or we'd fill their pockets full. You can't help but, you know what I mean?
And the demand, what is the demand?
It's
like?
Growing rapidly. Right now, we're getting ready to expand probably five times what this is.
Wow.
Because it's there. The need here is tremendous.
So the need far outstrips...
Yes.
What you're already able
to
provide.
Yeah. We'll empty this out. Yeah.
I mean, and this is enough to feed how many families?
We average about 75 families, and then we try to give them a week's worth of food. But we also know when we get more come. If we had twice this, they'd come.
Okay, time to give Doug Green another try. This is Michelle Fleury from BBC. You spoke to us 8 years ago. You may or may not remember. Success. I've finally spoken to Doug Green. He's agreed to speak to us. He hasn't seen his friend Billy Mitchell for a while, but they are friends on Facebook, so he's going to message him. Fingers crossed.
All right. Let's see if she'll start, right?
While waiting to hear back from Doug Green, Tom White offers me a different perspective on what's happening in this part of West Virginia. Tom is the proud owner of a rickety Cessna plane. It's clearly seen better days. As we climb out of the local airport, bumping around in the turbulence, I can't pretend I'm not a little nervous. West Virginia is the only state that lies completely within the Appalachian Mountain region. On the road, you can be blissfully unaware of the environmental damage wrought by coal mining, and it's not immediately apparent from the sky either. But once we get far enough south of Charleston and clear the clouds, the scale of the problem suddenly fills the view. Great swathes of the Appalachia mountain range have been blasted, obliterated. Mountains, as far as the eye can see, stand with their tops blown clean off. This is mountaintop removal, a form of surface mining that uses explosives to expose underlying coal seams. It's been described as strip mining on steroids. It was pioneered here in the 1970s, and it's highly controversial. The coal companies claim this form of surface mining is quicker, cheaper, and far safer than doing it underground. But it's the scarring of the landscape, more of a moonscape really, that stays with me.
Top off?
You know, it's the only way that you can understand this issue, by seeing it from the air. You can't understand it from the ground. This is a big issue, and it's not good enough to say no coal mining. That's not going to work. But the scale of this is not right. It's not what we want.
Do you think it will change come November when a new president's elected?
No, I don't. Maybe 20 years from now, things will be different, but I think it's going to take a while.
Still feeling a bit queasy from my flight and the destruction I've just witnessed, I'm keen to hear more about the environmental issues. So we drive an hour south to Coal River Mountain Watch, a small non-profit campaign group based in Nayoma, Raleigh County.
Appalachia is one of the most biologically diverse places on the planet. Right now, we're standing in the middle of a biodiversity hotspot.
Sporting a wild beard, ponytail, and a grubby Save the Endangered Hillbilly t-shirt, 26-year-old Junior Walk cuts a slightly disheveled figure. But he's sharp as a nail and obviously dedicated to protecting the land he grew up around. Junior is convinced of the negative environmental and health effects of mountaintop removal mining.
When I was a young kid, you know, from about the time I was 10 until I was 20, the water came out of our tap blood red every day. We had well water. These huge earthen dams, these slurry impoundments that you see, that's one of the ways that they get rid of this coal waste, this coal slurry. But the other way that they do it is by a process called underground coal slurry injection, where they take that coal slurry and pump it into old abandoned underground coal mines. And that's what they did on the ridgeline above my parents' house, and eventually made its way into our wells.
Raised on the banks of the Coal River, Junior hails from a family of miners. He too worked in the industry. It was either do that, join the military, or deal drugs, he says. But after just a few months, concerns for his own health, plus a guilty conscience, led him to quit. He joined Coal River Mountain Watch instead. His father, who still worked in the industry, kicked him out of the family home. He had little choice, says Junior. He'd have lost his job if he hadn't. Junior may be fighting the coal industry in coal country, but what he shares with the miners we've met is a sense of political alienation.
To be completely honest about it, I'm not a very political person. I mean, when Obama ran for president for the first time in 2008, I voted for Obama. You know, I thought I was doing something great. You know, I thought it was going to change the world getting Obama in the White House. Learn different. But, no, the fact of the matter is, I mean, you know, we're still in a constant war in the Middle East, and the president hasn't done anything about any of that, or really many of the social or economic problems that we have in this country.
So you're disappointed?
Oh, yeah.
But there's the Affordable Health Care Act, the Paris Climate Change Agreement. There have been some changes.
You know, for a certain portion of the population, there have been some changes, you know, but for the lower castes of our society and for people living in other places around the world, things haven't changed very much.
Will you vote this time around?
No. If voting ever changed anything, they'd have made it illegal by now.
Doug, Billy? You two are hard to track down and get together.
No, you're just not looking hard enough.
I just told Billy, I said, I don't know how many times I've talked to him, but I think...
After a slew of text messages, missed calls, and voicemails, I finally succeeded in tracking down Billy Mitchell and Doug Green. We joined them at their local diner in Danville. When the BBC spoke to them in 2008, Billy was worried America's focus on cleaner energy would damage West Virginia's coal industry. Since then, they've both retired and their focus has shifted. These days, instead of enjoying their free time, these two proud union men are now in a fight to keep what they've earned.
You know, we've had to fight for our pension, something that we were promised by President Truman years ago by our government.
1946 government guaranteed for the miners because we made the coal that made the steel that defeated Germany and defeated Japan.
Cradle to the grave benefits. That's how strong a promise it was. We've been beat to pieces, fingers, thumbs, broken bones, broken feet. We're not asking for anything that we haven't earned.
Billy, the coal industry here in West Virginia has been shrinking over the last few years. Is coal here dead? Does it have a future?
I think it's got a future. The thing of it is I don't think it'll ever return to what the numbers was when they had 500,000 people working in the 50s.
Hello.
Hello.
The waitress interrupts us to take our order. We take Doug's recommendation and order a Coney Island hot dog.
The waitress knew your order.
Well, she used to date my son. Oh, by the way, my children are all college graduates. There's no coal miners.
I was going to say, and are you glad about that?
Absolutely.
It was worth all the blood, sweat, and tears.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, as an outsider coming here, what is striking to me is how strongly people feel about the industry, a sense of loyalty to it. And yet, I watch and I kind of don't quite understand. I mean, the physical stress, the toll it takes, now fighting for your pensions, the health risks involved. What makes someone a coal person?
I graduated from high school. I was 17. Usually you're 18 before you can go to work. I changed my birth certificate. I went to work in the mines making $4.27 an hour. That's outrageous money then.
So it used to be a really good middle-class job.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. You know, it was a money thing. It was a money thing.
Listening to America Revisited with Michelle Fleury. Producer Ben Crichton and I are on the road, retracing a trip the BBC made across the US back in 2008, the year Barack Obama was elected president. We've barely left West Virginia and crossed into Ohio when flashing blue lights suddenly fill the rearview mirror.
Here's your license back, sir.
Thank you.
I gave you a speeding ticket.
Oh.
Fair enough, the court's right here. You got to call them, tell them you got a speeding citation. They'll give you the
$100 lighter and slightly shamefaced, we arrive in the city of Akron. Legend has it that two brothers here created the hamburger back in 1885. A few minutes up the road is Swenson's Drive-In, where you don't even have to leave your car to eat. We're here with Dowlett Dara and Travis Carlton, whom we met 8 years ago. Back then, they were high school students and too young to vote. But the year he was first elected, Barack Obama captured 66% of the youth vote. And young people in the US are now as large a political force as baby boomers.
So obviously I graduated high school. I went to the University of Akron and got a degree in chemical engineering. So now I work as a research and development engineer.
And Travis, what about you?
Well, I'm still working on my degree,
but I work as a IT professional, so I work in the help desk, and I just got married June 17th.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So you're a newly married man?
Yes. I've been in a relationship for just about 8 years now. So yeah, it was time. So I don't feel any different. The love is still the same.
Aww.
Yeah.
Good job, Travis.
Well, congratulations. Has that changed your outlook on life?
It teaches you how to, you know, not necessarily put your pride to the side, but it's helped me be a wiser man at the end of the day.
How have the last 8 years been under President Obama?
I think Obama and his administration did the best that they could with what they had. I mean, they had a lot of challenges with the Republicans and different things of that nature, voting and vetoing bills, many government shutdowns that we've had. I think, you know, they did the best with what they had at the time.
Is there a sense of disappointment, though?
I guess not disappointment, at least on my part, because I understand, you know, you can't expect one person to change everything.
So will you vote this November?
Oh, yeah. Definitely do a lot more research on the policies and listen to the debates a lot more, because it's a big deal.
And what, I mean, for you, what are the main issues?
Kind of like abortion thing, like pro-choice, pro-life. For me, it's about a woman or a person having the right to choose what they want to do with their body.
So social issues are more important for you?
Yes, for me right now they are.
And Travis, what are the main issues for you?
The economy, because I've seen how after 2008, the fallout, people losing jobs, homes, when the market crashed, it hit a lot of people very hard. And, you know, some of the people I knew. So that's just one of the things that I keep my eye on as far as what they're going to do with money. And the other thing that I keep my eye on is the issue with police brutality and different things of that nature, how that's going to be addressed.
I wanted to ask you a question you were asked 8 years ago. Does it bother you what people think about America? Does it hurt?
I think the image is like a lot of war, a lot of selfishness. I think that's a lot of what they see, a lot of greed, all about the money kind of thing. And I get why they would think that. You know, you see how what we do overseas, and some of our intentions are definitely not as good as they should be. And so I think that's the image that we get. And it makes me a bit sad that we're portrayed so badly, but I can understand why.
It's less than an hour's drive to Cleveland in northeastern Ohio on the southern shore of Lake Erie. Ohio is currently the epicenter of a nationwide opiate epidemic. Here, there are an estimated 200,000 opioid addicts. That's roughly the population of Akron, where we've just driven from. Drug overdoses kill more Americans than car crashes or guns, and experts say the crisis hasn't yet peaked. The main culprit seems to be prescription medication. 4 in 5 new heroin users started out misusing painkillers. St. Vincent Charity Medical Center in Cleveland has been at the sharp end of the fight against addiction.
Okay, so let's see if Chris is here. Hey, Chris, you in?
Yep.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Perrin here. Oh, how are the opiate withdrawal symptoms?
Pretty terrible.
Okay.
At St. Vincent's detox unit, Dr. Ted Perrin is on his first round of the morning. Softly spoken, with a neatly trimmed moustache and glasses, he's a nationally recognised expert on substance abuse and addiction. His patient, Chris, is 3.5 days into opiate withdrawal. Yesterday was his worst day, though I have to say to the untrained eye, Chris looks surprisingly healthy.
Like back pain, diarrhea,
okay.
Vomiting.
Any problems with any abscesses or cellulitis or anything like that?
Not at all.
No, that looks pretty good. Okay, good, good. Okay. Have you ever been tripped up in a relapse by a prescription? Say, you know, you hurt yourself or you got a pain problem and someone says, well, you know, take this medicine, it'll be safe.
Well, that's how I started using.
Okay.
I had my wisdom teeth taken out and I got like Vicodin or Percocets or whatever and I just took too many and I liked the feeling. And then I started just taking stronger pills and went to like Oxycontins and then they stopped making those, so I was supposed to switch to heroin.
Switch to heroin, yeah. Well, let's get you through the detox here and try to build some things in to guard against the relapse traps. We'll keep checking you every day and see how things are coming along.
Okay, cool.
West Virginia and the entire Appalachian area really was the beginning, the epicenter of the prescription opiate problem. People were prescribed tremendous amount of opiates for chronic pain issues when they're doing heavy manual physical labor, and it precipitated addictive disease. And the rest of the country has been gradually mirroring what has been going on in West Virginia and Appalachia ever since about 1996. As physicians have begun to pull back on their prescribing of opiates, really over the last 6 or 7 years, people have found themselves addicted but unable to get the prescription opioids, and the heroin dealers have stepped right in. The biggest problem in terms of the fatal overdoses now compared to previous epidemics is the mixture of illegal heroin with illegal fentanyl that has been introduced from China through Mexico into the United States. Fentanyl is an anesthetic. It's an opiate that's used for anesthesia. And since fentanyl is at least 100, if not 200 times stronger than heroin, and it's sort of randomly mixed in with the heroin, we've seen a huge surge of fatal overdoses.
Over the last 8 years, have the drug policies made a difference?
The efforts on the part of the federal government and the Obama administration to educate physicians about the risks as well as the benefits of prescribing opiates has been increasing in intensity and having a substantial positive effect. In addition, over the last 8 years, the Affordable Care Act, at least in states that have been willing to implement it, has provided much more insurance for people who are of limited economic means, and that has saved untold numbers of lives.
What would have happened to those people in the past?
Typically, they went to jail. Or they just stayed out on the streets, continuing to fall apart in every imaginable possible way as their addiction progressed.
You're very much on the front lines of dealing with this problem. What's it like personally when you lose a patient?
It's very, very difficult, and the patients who we're losing with this epidemic are young, often naive. And so the funerals and the wakes for young 18, 20, 22, 25-year-olds are very, very painful to go to. But I think it's also important to go to, not only to indicate some respect, but also to give the clear message to the friends and associates of the young person who has died, who often are at high risk themselves, that there is another way and that treatment can work and can help them have a different outcome.
Wow, that was pretty sobering talking to Ted Parron, both the scale of the problem but also the challenges in dealing with it. Anyway, right now I'm off to go meet one of his success stories. We've come to a well-to-do, middle-class Cleveland suburb to meet Connie Barone at her mother's house. In her late 40s, divorced, and the mother of two teenage girls, she seems like the last person to be tempted by drugs. But this drug epidemic has long and far-reaching tentacles.
I guess it was when I was about 27. I started getting migraine headaches, which runs in my family on my mother's side.
So how did the migraines make you feel?
Like something was being stabbed into one side of my head, and it would always be there. It was there almost every day. It was like a celebration when I had a good day. And believe it or not, I had a stroke at 27, being really healthy, normal weight. I was just not a candidate, not somebody you would think that would have a stroke. So that's when they prescribed me like opiates. They gave me energy, and you think you're being a good mother. But soon, when you become dependent and addicted on it, you then can't not have the medicine to function, or else you'll immediately go into withdrawal. You get nauseous, you get body pain, your bones hurt, it feels like. Withdrawal is miserable. So that's why it's so easy to get addicted to this stuff. Everything that you thought you'd never do, you start doing. You start looking in people's medicine cabinets, thinking, oh gosh, I would never steal from anybody. That's not me. But then you find yourself, you know, using their restroom, looking in their cabinets, and, you know, saying, well, it's not going to hurt if I take a few, or, you know, they've had these in here for 6 months. They don't need them anymore. So you kind of start making up excuses in your head. That's kind of the addiction, you know, talking.
And what happened when you couldn't get pills off your friends?
I knew people who would call me every month when they got their refill just to sell them to me. But back in those early years, I was buying opiates on the internet, hundreds and hundreds at a time, and they would ship them overnight. An online doctor somewhere was doing some sort of online evaluation with you and would prescribe narcotics on the internet.
So they would write a prescription without ever having seen a patient face to face?
Absolutely. So I ran up all of my credit cards. That's how my husband at the time found out, because the bills. It got really bad. I remember my kids, you know, in grade school, and I remember putting them in the car and driving downtown to meet somebody who sold them.
So you went to meet a black market dealer while your daughters were in the car?
Yes. There was one woman downtown who, she also had kids, and she, every time she'd get her prescription filled, she'd call me and she'd sell them to me.
Another mother.
Kids about the same age. Yeah. It was just total, total chaos in my life.
And were your daughters aware at that point of what was going on in your life?
No, they really didn't understand. They knew that mom was taking medicine and it wasn't good for her and she needed to stop taking it. She wasn't supposed to be taking it. I don't really think they knew really the whole, like, everything, you know?
Because they were young.
They were very young, yeah.
We're sitting here in your mother's house, beautiful house. You're not the typical picture I think many people have when they think of someone who's addicted to drugs.
Yeah, I've heard that. You know what? There is no picture. Now it's all ages. It's everybody. All walks of life.
After almost a decade of addiction, chaos and deceit, Connie finally managed to get clean. She now wants to use her experience to educate others.
So I always wanted to be a counselor my whole life. I was born to be a counselor. I just, what I did after I got clean is I went back to school and got my master's degree and learned the skills I needed. And so now I'm licensed as a professional counselor.
Do you talk about it with your daughters?
I do talk about it with my daughters because addiction is about 50% hereditary and 50%, you know, what goes on around you. So I constantly talk to my daughters. I never stop talking to them, never.
And how is your relationship with your mother these days?
Well, yeah, my mother and I are very close, but I tell you, we've been through my poor mother, what I've put her through, you know, and my father. But I'm very close with my mother, and I'm happy. I'm finally in a happy place. And, you know, I did do it in my 40s, but that's okay. It doesn't matter how old you are. If you decide that you want to change your life, only you can do it. Nobody can do that for you.
We've said goodbye to the Rust Belt and arrived in New York. The Big Apple is famous not just for its skyline and vibrant city life, but for its cultural and ethnic diversity too. But even so, one group in particular isn't feeling so welcome. Islamophobia seems to be on the rise in America.
I bear witness to the fact that Muhammad ibn Abdullah, sallallahu alayhi wasallam, is his servant and final messenger.
Here at New York University's Islamic Center, it's Friday prayers. As worshippers file outside, some drifting into nearby Washington Square Park, we meet two young women, 18-year-old New York University student Asma Bengabsia and her 24-year-old friend Amania Al-Katadba. Amania is the founder of MuslimGirl.net, a blog site that aims to debunk stereotypes and promote the place of Muslim women in Western societies.
We wear the flag of Islam on our heads, and because of that, we're walking targets. I mean, I know women that have had the scarves on their heads ripped off of them in public. You know, like, this isn't something that's new. And racism permeates our everyday experiences. You know, even just this past 9/11 anniversary, one of my friends, she texted me and she said, "Are you going to prayer today?" And I asked her, "Of course I am. Why not?" And she said, "Because it's 9/11. So I told her, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to go, but I'm going to conceal my headscarf. I'm going to wrap it in different ways." So it's kind of religiously ambiguous. And it's those internalized micro defenses that we have just to be able to survive and navigate society today and the way people view us. That's really how it's impacted our everyday lives and our everyday experience.
I've definitely had to stay home on certain days because of hate crimes being on a rise, whether it was a local hate crime that just happened after a tragedy happened, such as the San Bernardino shooting or the Paris attacks. The elders in our community and our parents being the first ones will tell us, stay home for the next few days, don't go out, come home as early as possible, try to avoid public places. And it's insane because I hit this identity crisis, like, wait, but I have nothing to do with that. I can't even walk outside the house and completely feel safe and reassured because of something that happened across the country or across the globe. I constantly ask myself, well, am I not American either? And I was born in Brooklyn, raised in Jersey. Do I not have the right to walk safely within this country that I call home?
You know, what do you feel first? Do you feel American first? Do you feel Muslim first? I don't even know how you process that question of identity.
I would answer both. Why are American and Muslim mutually exclusive? They're not. Why are they two different things? Islam preaches freedom of religion. America preaches freedom of religion. We often say, well, would she choose Allah first or would she choose to follow the law first? Well, it's both. My religion tells me to respect the law of the land that I'm in. And I truly think that Islam is what makes American Muslims better citizens.
The election of Barack Obama allowed people to dream that America might finally be moving into a post-racial era. I asked Amania if she thought her president had done enough to achieve this.
Unfortunately, I don't think so. And I feel like there could have been so much more potential for him to take our society forward, especially as the first black president, everything that his presidency symbolized. But I feel like when those opportunities arose, he unfortunately just reaffirmed a lot of the negative frameworks that people already held about minorities in our country.
With so much at stake, how important is the election this November?
I would say that no matter who wins this November, I feel like communities of color have already lost. I feel like we've been the ones that have been the pawns in the election cycle. We've been the ones who have had our livelihoods be placed on a policy platform. We have been yet again alienated from the conversation that's been happening around who should lead our country. No matter who takes the lead, we're still going to see that.
Take exit 4 on the right. 15 minutes from the George Washington Bridge, and we're driving through the Palisades. Most of the houses here are large and detached, with neatly manicured front lawns and white picket fences. Flags flutter in the warm breeze. It's a distinctly suburban, middle-class picture.
Take exit 4 on the right.
8 years ago, the BBC came here to speak to Kurt Bridges. Back then, he and his wife Kristen had one son. Today, they have two more. At the time, Kurt feared for his business, so I'm keen to find out how his family has coped.
We probably watched our revenues drop by 60 to 70% in a year. We just had clients drop off the face of the earth. Fortunately, that was only for a year and a half. Things bounced back. And we're on an upward trend again for the last 6 years or so.
Did the policies of the Obama administration, trying to revive the economy, did they help you?
I don't think in a direct sense they helped, but I think the economy got shored up. which trickled down from the big businesses to small businesses like mine. So in that regard, yeah, I think it helped.
And business isn't his only concern. Since we last met him, Kurtz had more pressing issues to contend with.
I found a lump in my neck when I was in the gym, and I ended up having something called squamous cell carcinoma, which I had never heard of. It was essentially a cancer in my tonsil. And I remember the doctor called us that night and said, look, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is you have cancer. The good news is you have the cancer anybody with cancer would like to have. It's treatable, and it's very, very, very curable.
And how are you doing now?
Now I'm doing great. I'm back at the gym. I eat right. I live right. I treat myself like I want to live another 40 or 50 years. So, yes.
So that's wonderful. You've got the all clear.
Yes, I've got the all clear.
How would you have fared if you hadn't had private healthcare?
We went through with Kristen's cousin that it was...
Who had passed away.
She passed away.
I should just jump in here to explain that Kristen's cousin was on government insurance, Medicaid, while Kurt and Kristen paid for their own private insurance.
She was a single mom, raising her two children, worked two or three jobs just to make ends meet, qualified for Medicaid.
It was very disjointed.
There was no continuation of care. We pay an exorbitant amount of money. I mean, basically, it's like a college education, what we pay for healthcare right now.
Can I ask how much?
I think back then it was about 20 grand a year, somewhere in there.
$20,000?
Yes. And I remember before my illness even wondering, is this really worth it? Kristen doesn't get sick. I don't get sick. Well, you know, maybe we should just put the money aside. And thank God I didn't.
Years ago, there was this feeling of hope, of change. Now, going into November, I mean, there seems to be a lot more, I don't know what the word is, disillusionment? I mean, what word would you use to describe your mood right now?
Battered wife syndrome? I mean, I think...
Battered wife syndrome.
I probably the wrong metaphor to use, but it's like, you know, we've been beaten up.
Given what you've just said, do you still feel proud to be an American?
Yes, I do. Women are respected here and treated very well in the States. There's opportunity for my boys to go to college, get an education, to have jobs, to hopefully develop lives for themselves. When I compare what other countries go through, I feel very thankful just to be able to go into a grocery store and get fresh produce.
I still think we live in a great country. You know, there's still thousands of people every day who want to come into the U.S. because it offers a chance. It offers upward mobility, food on the table, basic human rights, like things that we really do take for granted. Like any family, are there a few warts? Are there a few, you know, is there a misguided cousin that maybe you wish wasn't at the family picnic? Yes, but... It's still great. It's still a great family.
Swept into the Oval Office on a wave of optimism, Barack Obama promised to heal America's wounds. And there was a lot of healing to do. Conflict abroad, poverty at home, and an economy in freefall. With so many hopes and dreams at stake, it's perhaps not surprising that a lot of the people we've spoken to feel let down. Seduced by the prospect of a new America, they forgot that no one man or woman can solve America's problems. It's a lesson Obama's successor, whoever that might be, would do well to remember. Join us again in 2 weeks when some of the people we spoke to in this series will discuss the issues it's raised. That's America Revisited, The Debate. On October the 8th, here on the BBC World Service.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.